So did you go over to that?
We are going to start the State Government Finance Committee meeting. Members, in your packet, you have minutes for April 7th, 2015. Representative Lunan, you want to move the minutes?
I move that we approve the minutes as submitted.
Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes for April 7th, 2015 have been approved. Welcome, Representative Knobloch. You have House File 2013. I will move that to be laid over for possible inclusion in the State Government Finance Omnibus Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you could you also then move the DE1 amendments so we can bring that before the committee for discussion?
Yes, we've got the DE1 amendment for Representative Knobloch. Members, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, Representative Knobloch, with House File 2013 as amended, you also have the DE2 amendment, it looks like, too.
I do, Madam Chair. And, Madam Chair, members, I'll talk about the DE2 amendment in a little bit, particularly when I hope Dr. Columba Kiedis, the state economist, is here. Members, the reason I'm bringing House File 2013 as amended before you is what this bill does is it provides more information, ideally with the forecast, the budget forecast twice a year, as to what the potential effects of a recession would be on the state budget. It's been my observation that probably nothing affects the legislature more than the onset of a recession, and oftentimes I think members don't fully realize, if they're a new member, what the effects of a recession might be on state revenues. And even those members who have been around longer, if there has not been a recession for a while, or if there hasn't been a serious one, as revenues have grown, as the economy's grown, as budgets have grown, they may also not realize just what an effect of a recession might be. And of course, we've just gone through a serious one in the last 4 years. Those who were here in 2011 and 12 experienced a real difficult budget time. But what I'm trying to do with House File 2013 is provide more information to members of the legislature, just so they're aware as they do their budgeting process that they would keep this in mind. I guess one of the other things, members, is that while we have been doing budget forecasts for decades, there has never yet been one forecast that has forecast a recession, even though there have obviously been periodic recessions many, many times. And in fact, none of the national economic forecasting models that I have seen have also ever forecasted a recession. Maybe it's because they're afraid that it'll become a self-fulfilling prophecy. But we can't really rely on any of the national economic model companies that we hire to prepare the forecast to give us a recession forecast. It's not something that economists typically do. And given that, until the state-of-the-art changes, I guess I just felt that we would be well-served if we had more information. What House File 2013 with the DE1 amendment does is it says that each forecast must, based on the past history of the state, give a range of what sort of effects we might see on state revenues from the onset of a recession so that we would be able to get a sense of what the impacts might be if that would happen. And I guess I'd be happy to, and I'd appreciate people's input on the DE1 amendment. The DE2 amendment is some language that the state economist brought forward to me, and I, if she's here, I'd like her. Once we're maybe done with the DE1 amendment, we can perhaps bring the DE2 amendment forward and talk about that too. But with that, members, I'm open for questions.
I think Representative Knobloch, what we'll do is we'll have Dr. Columba Kiedis come down, and then she can speak to that, and then we can speak to the bill as a whole with questions at that point.
That's fine.
So. And it's Columba Kiedis, correct?
That's right.
Okay. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning. I'm Laura Columba Kiedis. I'm the state economist and professor at the University of Minnesota, and I represent Minnesota Management and Budget. So I as the person who's responsible for the revenue forecast, I applaud every effort to shed light on the risks associated with risks and uncertainties associated with the forecast, so that legislators can understand what the upside and downside risks are. And so with that in mind, I applaud Representative Knobloch's efforts to, in particular, shed light on the impact, potential impact on revenues of an economic downturn. However, I don't think that forecasting or estimating the effects of a recession is necessarily the best way to help legislators understand all of the risks of the forecast, for a couple of reasons. One is that recessions vary a great deal in their dynamics, how and why they start, how deep they get, whether or not how long they are, and whether or not they affect Minnesota differently than other places. And so for us to estimate the effects of a recession coming, you know, some period after the forecast would mean that we would have to make some judgments about what kind of recession it is. So is it a recession that happens because of a financial crisis, because of a housing crisis, because of an energy or water shortage, or is it consumer spending that went down? And then try to create a consistent story and a consistent set of variables to play that through with an estimate. So that's one reason. And so those differential dynamics mean that there would be quite a bit of subjectivity associated with a recession forecast. Another reason is that I think that this isn't necessarily the best way to provide information about risk and uncertainty is because at the time that we prepare a forecast, we do have some ideas, and we certainly discuss them in the forecast document, about what the upside and downside risks are to the forecast. So the macroeconomic consultant that we use, IHS Economics, provides us with information about what they think might happen, their baseline scenario, and then what alternative stories there might be that might play out. If a recession is not in those alternative scenarios, so if it's really unlikely that there's a recession, then it might not be that informative for us to forecast the impact of a recession. And then another reason is that the risk of a recession is not the only source of revenue forecast error. We could have the economy perfectly forecast. So, for instance, imagine that we know everything that's going to happen in the economy. We know there's going to be a recession. We know how it's going to affect consumer spending and profits and all of that. We still would not target our revenue forecast perfectly. So our revenue forecast can be off even if the economy is perfectly forecast. So there are other risks and uncertainties associated with the revenue forecast, including our own forecast error. Providing that information creates more of a complete picture than just the impact of a potential recession. So our position in the economic analysis unit at MMB is that we applaud the effort to shed light on the risks of the forecast, and Representative Knobloch's proposal has led to some very productive, I think, conversations among the economists at MMB and others about what we can and cannot do and what would and would not be helpful. Our preference with the resources that we have is for the language not to change. We did provide Representative Knobloch with the alternative language that includes looking at our complete forecast error and providing some information about the forecast error based on our history. And that's what the alternative piece is about. And so I'm happy to take questions about that.
And Madam Chair, maybe I guess with Dr. Kolumbakidis up here, maybe just to be in proper form, someone could move the DE2 amendment so that it's officially before us, and it can be talked about, too.
And I will move the DE2 amendment, and Representative Knobloch, do you want to say any other comments before I ask the public to see if there's anybody from the public that wishes to testify, and then we'll go to questions?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess only that, I mean, I think the state economist has been accurate enough in their forecasting that while there's certainly potential forecast error, even if the economy is forecast perfectly, I don't think it's been in the past a serious enough error that it's a serious problem for us. I mean, no one expects that we're going to have a perfectly accurate forecast. It seems to me the bigger risk is that you have an economic downturn. I suppose it wouldn't have to be a recession, but an economic downturn that then does impact the revenues. But with that, yeah, Madam Chair, I'll open it up to anyone else that wants to testify.
Okay. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify to this bill? If not, Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I'm one of the co-authors of the bill, and I just thought a little background as to why one. I had a conversation, a brief one, the other day with Representative Knobloch about the proposal. What came to my mind was a conversation that I had initiated by a former state economist, and I was chairing the finance committee, and he set up a meeting with myself and Lauren Solberg, and I assume he did on the Senate side. And this was in the interim before the November forecast. And he shared with us some red flags that he saw on the horizon. One of them was housing, and there were a few other indicators that he was pushing some alarm buttons with, and this was before the forecast. The conversation took place before the Great Recession. And if you'll recall, you know, housing, the impact on the lumber industry in Minnesota, there were several indicators. And yet there wasn't a whole lot we could do with that information. It wasn't a part of an official forecast. I assume that information became available to him, well, I know it did, sometime between the February forecast and then the November forecast. So I think we have an issue here that Representative Knobloch has brought forward in terms of how we look at these forecasts. You know, I noticed the one big difference between Amendment 1 and 2 is the avoidance of the word recession. But both seem to have the goal of trying to get a handle on what the swings might be in terms of what the revenue for the state may be. And I guess I'm very open to suggestions from Representative Knobloch on which amendment, but I truly think we should do something. I know that your comment was the preference, and I assume you had consulted with the other economists to stay with the status quo, but I do think we have an issue that somehow needs to be resolved in terms of when we get information and how we get it and what the probability might be. I guess that's what we're really talking about when the forecast is put together, what kind of revenue swings we might possibly see. So I don't know that I really had a question. It was more a comment as a co-author of the bill, but trying to share a little bit of the history and some of the problems that we do encounter with forecasting. And I know that Representative Knobloch and I currently sit in on the meetings, and I think that there was some concern at some point about the use of the word recession, and that's probably where you're coming at it from with Amendment 2, in the sense that a feeling that it might possibly be self-fulfilling. But be that as it may, I think we do need more information. So I'll just stop there, and I don't know if if either of them wants to comment or not.
Representative Knobloch or Dr. Kalimbakidis?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I guess I would just say I You know, I bring it forward to get other ideas from all of you as well. I guess I do think that we should do something. I'm not particularly wedded to the language. I guess the one issue I'd probably have with the DE2 amendment that I've talked to Dr. Columbakidis about is I think I'd be fine with all the language, except I'd really, if it was possible, like it to be included in the forecast. However, that may be difficult because of the workload, but I guess it's just my observation that when the forecast comes out, there's a lot of publicity. The Ways and Means Committee and Senate Finance Committee has a meeting within a week, and I'm just concerned that 14 days later the information will get kind of lost. But anyway, I also appreciate the workload Dr. Columbakidis has, and I'm open to other ideas from people too.
Okay. We've got Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like the second one more because I think it gets at to what it is that's needed, and that's the notion of uncertainty, revenue uncertainty. And to the doctor, isn't that kind of what we're trying to get at? It's the probability of its range of accuracy, the estimate. I mean, that's the information that that'd be most useful for planning purposes, I would. But can you say just a little bit more about that?
Dr. Columbakidis?
Madam Chair, Representative. So there are a couple of differences between the idea of an alternative forecast and the range of forecast errors or the confidence intervals that we're proposing in the second piece. And one is range idea gets at how much the forecast might be off between the time we make the forecast and the time we end the biennium. And so we can track for each biennium from the first February forecast to the end how far off we were, and then average over those errors over from biennium to biennium over a number of biennia, and then we use those average errors to estimate from, for instance, this last February forecast for FY 14-15 and for 16-17, how far might we be off to the upside and the downside? So a confidence interval. And that's the information that amendment proposes to provide. And so that incorporates the economic risk and the taxpayer behavior risk, so you know, we don't know exactly how taxpayers are going to behave, and our modeling risk, so all of those things. And so it can lead to a statement of, here's the baseline forecast. Based on our history with forecast error, we think that ultimately the number is going to be between this and this. So that's the kind of information that we provide. And then another kind of piece of information that I think Representative Knobloch has been is interested in seeing, which and I totally understand this as well, is how much might revenues fall if there is a recession next year or within a particular time period. And those are two different things, because one is a change in revenues year over year. So how much might revenues change from 2015 to 2016 versus how much might the forecast change between now and the close of the biennium. So those are a couple of the differences. I want to respond briefly to something Representative Carlson said, and I'm you know, more information, timely information. What we want is for our forecasts to be useful, credible, timely. And so anything we can do within the constraints of our resources to do that, I'm happy to do. And so, as I said, this has led to some productive conversations about how we might beef up, for instance, or change the communication in our forecast document about risks, economic risks, and about uncertainty. Also within our quarterly reports, so we produce a quarterly report that describes changes in the economy since the last quarterly report of the last forecast and changes in receipts. And so that's another place that we can report sort of red flags if we see them. And another point that I think would be helpful for people to think about is, in the budget process and post-forecast, we produce our forecast, and that is the single official forecast. But if there are multiple numbers out there, for instance, there is an upside forecast and a downside forecast, how is that going to change the conversation here or the process of budgeting? Because the budgeting is done to the single number. And again, more information is better than less information, but I think that, that the impact on that process is worth thinking about.
Representative Johnson.
Feedback then, Chair Knobloch, I guess it seems like the second one gives you more specific factual information that'd be useful.
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Carl Johnson. I don't know that I have a problem, like I said, with the second one, except that I would like to have it be part of the forecast, if it could be, for the reasons I stated before.
Okay. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate our discussion and the importance of having transparency when you're providing these budget figures. You know, what I know is usually recessions are determined retrospectively. So I don't really like to use the word recession. So I think I prefer the DE2 amendment as well. And I'm just wondering, in your budget forecast model, I'm assuming you're putting things in like housing markets indicators and unemployment, and you're looking back and using prior periods of your forecast error and your accuracy and the revenues from the past that go, that they all go into your model. So you can update that model with once you get new data. So the likelihood of recession, those indicators are in your forecast model. Is that correct?
Dr. Kalambakidis?
Madam Chairman, Representative, yes. The modeling starts with a U.S. macroeconomic forecast that comes from a consulting firm, IHS Economics. And they provide their baseline, all their baseline variables, which are a set of macroeconomic variables that are all internally consistent with one another, and consistent with what they expect to happen. And then we use those variables and Minnesota-specific information, including our own historic trends in Minnesota, and we develop a Minnesota economic model that produces estimates of employment and wages and salaries, housing market effects, demand for housing, all those kinds of things specific to Minnesota. So it's related to the U.S. economy. We add to it Minnesota-specific information, and from the Minnesota economic model and the U.S. economic model, those variables feed into our revenue models. So then we're estimating individual income tax, sales tax, corporate income tax, and others. And there specifically is where our own experience with our receipts and our revenues and how far off we were, those kinds of things, that's where that information comes in. So we have some ideas based on history of, for a given amount of tax liability, when do taxpayers typically pay, so that we can translate from liability to fiscal year receipts. So we do continuously update the models and update our thinking about it, because there are decisions to be made. They're not turnkey models. We have to make decisions at many points. Like, we have conflicting information about something, which information are we going to go with? So we're constantly updating our thinking about that stuff too.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one last question. How accurate is this model in the last few bienniums? And how much of it, how well are you able to predict the revenue?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Representative, Madam Chair, let me look up the numbers. Where did I put that? We measure it. Oh, there we go. Yeah, thank you. We measure it with a couple of different measures, looking at our average error, so the how different the endpoint was from the forecast, and that error changes as you move through time. So, for instance, the error from the first February forecast is going to be much higher than the error from at the last February forecast, because we have more information and more of the money is in the bank. So over time, that error changes. So, for instance, for a forecast 29 months out, the mean average error, so that's the first February forecast, the mean average error, which means the mean absolute error, so it means we're measuring error without respect to sign, Okay, mm-hmm. So the error could be up or down, and that's another difference here with this language is that it's looking at both the upside and the downside. So looking at the absolute value of the error and then averaging it over time, the error is about 5.4% on average. There's another measure of error that we use, and that's called the root mean squared error, and all that means is it's still an absolute error, but we square it, so that means that larger errors get penalized more. So if you're thinking that small errors aren't that big a deal, but a large error really is a big deal, so then we measure it that way, and that's 6.6% from the first February forecast to the end of the biennium. That measure, we are basing this, we're inspired by this, work that was done by the Congressional Budget Office where they estimate their own forecasting error, and so that's how we thought to do it. Mm-hmm. And our error is actually lower than theirs at this point.
Okay. Members, we do have three other bills on the docket. I just want to make one comment. What I see between these two are two different things that they're getting after. I think the errors are a different thing from what the DE1 amendment is asking for when we're talking about the recession and the impact that would have. So I think we are talking about two separate things, and that's how I view it. But with that, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you kind of articulated exactly what I was maybe going to lead down to. And Dr. Kolumbakidis, in your last reference, you talked about the root mean squared, and from an economics perspective, you talk about the deviation from the mean. And what we're really trying to look at is how accurate the forecast is based upon rolling periods, and whether that's 3, 5, or 10 years, and your efficiency in forecasting the state's economy based upon that overarching federal model that you first use. Mm-hmm. And you also kind of mentioned a reference to the LBO or the OMB office, and we also heard testimony in a bill that would also establish a state model for that same in terms of the Legislative Budget Office. And I'm just wondering if that, my first question would be to see whether or not that piece or that tool would be helpful to you in terms of smoothing that standard deviation. Whether that office would be helpful in terms of calling balls and strikes in terms of, because it isn't only just about economics that go on in the state, but it also has a reference in terms of the legislative effect of new tax policy, new regulatory policy from an economic perspective, and how that would feed into that model. So I'm just wondering if, my first question would be in terms of, if we had our own CBO, at the state level, if that would be helpful to you in terms of reducing the standard deviation from the mean in terms of your forecasting model.
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know enough about what that proposed office would do to know what kind of information might be provided that we don't already get. So at the moment, our forecasting process, we work, at least one of our models, the income tax model, is shared among legislative staff here, the nonpartisan legislative staff, and Department of Revenue. There's a lot of collegial sharing of information, sharing of ideas, for modeling ideas. And so we already, I feel like we are already getting the best ideas and best information from the people who know it among legislative staff and among agency staff. We have lots of conversations at many different staff levels with Minnesota Department of Revenue in terms of their revenue forecast, their revenue estimation and collections. The Department of Revenue produces the sample of tax returns that we use for our simulation models. And so maybe there's somebody who knows something that could help us who hasn't shared that yet. But at the moment, I feel like we have the best minds already at our disposal. I'm open to anything that can help improve the accuracy of the forecast. But the system that we have in place has been working very well for a long time.
Madam Follow Chair. Up, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We talk about the diversity of the state's economy, and as it would be reflective of the the nation's economy. And if you talk about the velocity of going into a recession or the velocity coming out of a recession as it would pertain to the state's economy, one of the things that I hear around the table and maybe from the two amendments is to have the Council of Economic Advisors give more emphasis in terms of what could corrupt that forecast, whether it be a slowdown in mining, it may be some type of a debacle in our medical community, whether it be from research or how, as an example, federal health care policy would affect some of our health care providers here, the agricultural community in terms of, you know, if we had a calamitous event in terms of rust on wheat or some type of a environmental effect that affected the sugar beet production, that type of thing. Is there any opportunity for leeway or an expansion of what the Economic Advisor Council provides, not disclaimers, but say these are some things that we're also concerned about that would have a dramatic impact in terms of the velocity of our state's economy going forward, Madam Chair?
Dr. Columbakidis.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, those are really, really good points. So Minnesota's economy is tied to the U.S. economy. If the U.S. goes into a recession, chances are good Minnesota's going to go into a recession, although the 1991 recession, Minnesota was relatively unharmed, so it's not, that's not necessarily true. But your point is very well taken that our concern as forecasters and the concern of the Council of Economic Advisors should be, what's the likelihood of an economic downturn in the United States economy? And that is the focus of the Council, because the Council's role is to evaluate the macroeconomic, the U.S. economic forecast. However, they all have some expertise related to the state, to regions of the state or particular sectors of the state. And so they do provide us with information about, here's what's happening in Duluth, here's what's happening in St. Cloud, here's what's happening in logging and mining. And so you're right that that second layer is going to be very important for Minnesota, which is, what is it about this particular downturn that we might be heading into that could hit Minnesota particularly hard? And we talked about that when we released the forecast about things like the strong dollar hurting exports, and that's going to affect agriculture, and that's going to affect the mining industry, that's going to affect manufacturers. That point is very well taken, that both what's going to happen in the U.S. economy and then what's unique to Minnesota, what's the Minnesota-specific risk? That's something that we can ask for more information on, and we can provide more information on in our document.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that many, if not all, of the things being bantered about here should be in your basic model that you're giving us the forecast. And if they're not, then we're going to need a good new model. And I don't know why we're all adding little bits in here, because if they're not, then we better hear about it. If those things that you are describing and the way you create your forecast doesn't include a possible recession, you're not doing the right thing. So let's admit that either you got a bad model or you're doing all this stuff, and get on with it.
Okay. Is that just a comment, Representative Earhart?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Earhart. Representative Kahn.
Yes. Well, you know, unfortunately, when I approach topics like this, I have to go back to my basic educational background, which relies heavily on the proper use of mathematics or even just basic arithmetic. And the thing that's bothered me for some time, and I guess there are bills in to do this, is the fact that our forecast is forbidden to include the possible effect of inflation on it. But we're not, there are two bills introduced right now. I think I'm a co-author on both of them, House File 883 and House File 882 by Representative Rosenthal, and both of them remove this, I think, arithmetic incongruity from the statute, one that removes, either just strikes the line that says you can't include any inflation in the forecast, or the other one that, and the mathematic incongruity is that we're not forbidden to, that's in the budget going out, but we're not forbidden to include it in the budget coming in. So, for example, tax collection is based on estimates of inflation and salaries and so forth. So one of them just strikes it in both directions, and the other one just strikes the saying that you can't include it in the forecast revenue. What are your thoughts about that, and how do you really deal with this as someone who I guess must recognize, I would hope would recognize an imbalance in an equation when it's presented to you?
Dr. Kolomakidis, do you have a brief response?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, the issue of inflation in the forecast is on the expenditure side.
Yes.
Not the revenue side. So everybody pays their taxes in current or nominal dollars, so that's already incorporated into the revenue side. We don't add inflation, it's just automatically in there. And so we forecast nominal dollars because that's what people pay, that's what the checks come in as. On the expenditure side, I would encourage you to have this discussion with the budget director, the commissioner of management and budget, but my understanding is that there are elements of increases in costs in some of the expenditure measures, and to sort that out is less straightforward than you might think, but I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. Representative Kahn?
I don't understand, Madam Chairman and Dr. Kolomakidis. I don't quite understand how, if you're going a forecast into the next, and I thought it was included, that you don't make an assumption that salaries are going up, that the taxes paid are going up because you've made an assumption when you're looking at the budget into the next year that salaries are going up. That's only one part of it, obviously.
Dr. Kolomakidis?
Madam Chair, Representative, my focus is on the revenue side, and so I don't actually know precisely where on the expenditure side those cost increases are and are not included, and so I would defer to the experts on the expenditure side.
Representative Kahn.
Okay, I just don't understand how a forecast doesn't have revenue on one side and expenditures on the other side in terms of what we expect to do.
Representative Lane.
If everyone else understands it, I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that the DE2 amendment is actually saying what we already do. It's just saying in 14 years report it. Is that not correct, that you already know the range of forecast error and the methods used to do that? It's just saying tell us in 14 days. Is that not true?
Dr. Kolomakidis?
Madam Chair, Representative, we often, not always, but we often post-forecast look at this information for our own benefit just so that we know how we're doing and make the calculations. But we've never validated it and put it into a piece that we could communicate and help other people make sense of. And so that's the additional work.
Okay.
Representative Lane.
And then the DE1 is, as you said, a different subject altogether. It's trying to look into a glass ball and figure out what might be coming down the pike. If the original bill had to do with that, I think that the DE2 kind of ignores what the original intent was. The question is whether it is possible to guess whether some downturn is coming, and the use of that, I do think that we need to use, as you said, a number for actual planning, budgeting to a single number. However, we also need to be aware that it is a forecast. The public certainly thinks of it as money in the bank already, especially even 29 months out, but it's not, and we need to be aware that it's not, that it's a forecast. So having some idea of possible upturns and downturns, I don't know if that's this particular way or just in our own consciousness that we need to be aware of it, but if we had something like this, we might consider putting more on in reserves. We might consider preparing in some sense for it. I think this is good conversation. I just don't know if it can be done.
Representative
Just briefly, in terms of the difference between the DE1 and the DE2, I guess in the DE1, I mean, it does talk about a range of the decrease in revenues, and so I think I'm getting at the same thing that Dr. Kolomakidis is talking about. The main difference, I think, really is that I'm not so concerned about the forecast error on the upside. I mean, if things are good, well, then we've got more money to decide to cut taxes with or spend, and it's not a particular crisis. I guess I'm more concerned with what happens if there's an error on the downside, and that's why I crafted the DE1 amendment the way I did. But I think you can get the same information out of the DE2 amendment.
Representative Lane? That's it. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. I'm not going to try to pronounce your name, Doctor. You said at the beginning of your...
It's a test, though, you know.
I know. I just failed, so that's okay. We should all have easy names like Nelson and Anderson. The question I have is, in your beginning of your statement, what you said, you like the language like it is. So are you saying you like the language of the original bill? Or do you like the language as in current law and don't want the bill at all? I guess that's the question I have in my mind.
Dr. Lambakidis.
Madam Chair, Representative, fair question. Our preference is no change to the statute, so current law. We'll keep doing things the way we are doing them. But this conversation, as I said, has been very productive and it has already changed our thinking about how we will communicate about the risks to the forecast when we communicate about them.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so... You would rather keep current law. If this bill goes forward, of the three versions that we have in front of us here, which do you prefer? I guess is the other question we have. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Representative, our preference if a bill goes forward is the DE2 language.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, all this discussion about forecast brings back when Rebecca Coles left doing the weather on Channel 4, and they were interviewing on TV about what she was going to do if this program she was going to didn't succeed, and she came back and said, I can always go back to guessing the weather. And so we're here talking about our best guess, and I guess I agree with Representative Knobloch and Representative Carlson that the more information we have for all of us here that maybe don't deal with all the intricacies of this, probably the better.
Okay. Representative Knobloch, you have the last word.
Well, I just would encourage people who have other ideas on how they'd like to modify this to contact me. I do intend to talk to Representative Carlson some more to get his ideas. I appreciate the work that Dr. Kalambakidis and her staff have done. I know they've done a lot in the last few months that we've been talking about this, and I appreciate her input, too, and thank members for their consideration.
Okay. Members, at this point, what I think I'm going to do is we are just laying this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I think that Representative Knobloch and Representative Carlson will be continuing to work, I imagine, with Dr. Kalambakidis and all the interested stakeholders on this issue. So at this point, I would like to remove my motion on the DE2 amendment, ask that you guys go back to the woodshop, so to speak, and try and find a good spot where you're all on the same page and getting at the same issues that you're looking for. And we'll just lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus state government finance bill and get a report back from you at some point on what kind of language you've been able to work out. So with that, I'm laying this bill over, and thank you for coming forward today. We have Representative Gunther is next on the list. Welcome, Representative Gunther. I'm going to move House File 744, and if you can please give a description of your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 744 is a Board of Accountancy bill. The first part of the bill revises the definition of a test to make Minnesota statute consistent with national standards. The second major element in the bill raises civil penalties amount from $2,000 to $5,000 for a person or firm that violates an order, statute, or rule that the board has issued or is empowered to enforce. There is not there's not a new penalty or a new enforcement, only the amount is changed. And that hasn't changed for quite a while. And Madam Chair and members, I have Greg Steiner, the President of the Board of Accountancy, to give testimony on the bill.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is Greg Steiner, and I am the Chairman of the State Board of Accountancy. I represent the State Board of Accountancy.
Proceed.
Madam Chair, the revision to the test language is the definition of a test is being updated in the rule. This will make it consistent with national standards that are consistently understood by CPAs in the state who practice in the state of Minnesota, and it is revised language that is modeled after the Uniform Accountancy Act that's jointly developed by the National Association of State Board of Accountancies and the American Institute of CPAs. The other change is the significant change is the change in the civil penalty. Again, that does not change the authority of the Board of Accountancy, and it does not change the board's enforcement. It only increases the amount, and that amount has been in effect for 35 years, the current amount.
Okay. All right, thank you. And members, we do have an amendment, a 15 amendment. It's on page 1, line 21, and it's just removing the stricken language and independent so that it still reads as peer review means an independent study, appraisal, or review. Do we need to delete the A in there, Mr. Shepard?
Madam Chair, yes, and the amendment actually does that.
Too. Okay. Members, any questions to the amendment? Chair Gunther.
I appreciate your support in this bill. I think it's something that the Board of Accountancy wants to do in their upgrade for their organization.
Okay. All those in favor of the A15 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. We have House File 744 before us as amended. Is there anyone else wishing to testify to this bill? Members, questions? Okay. With that, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus state government finance bill. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Representative Mack. Okay, we'll do this instead. We'll take Representative Smith. We're going to do Representative Smith's bill, House File 1470.
There's no reason that some of these could
Madam Chair, I have a treat for the committee.
Oh, wow. I like freshmen. Thank you, Representative Smith.
You make up a rule to bring treats up.
Oh, you wow.
I'll let you be all through with the Education Committee.
Yeah, I heard it.
Representative Smith, I'm going to move House File 1470 be laid over for possible inclusion in the state government finance bill. Welcome. If you can please give a description of your bill.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, House File 1470 is the technical bill for the Secretary of State business fees and filings. There's some financial impact, and we wanted to discuss that today. I have Mr. Bert Black from the Secretary of State's office to walk through the specifics.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and members. My name is Bert Black. I'm the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State. And the bill before you today has both policy and fiscal sections. The fiscal sections are Sections 1 and Section 2. Section 1, both of those sections involve going to a flat fee. Section 1 involves federal tax lien fees. These are filings we get from the IRS. The current law provides that the fee is $15 for the first two debtors on the tax lien and an additional $15 for each additional name. We don't currently have the computing capability to detect the additional names, and if we did try to program those functionalities, it would be many thousands of dollars. We would get very little revenue from the IRS in this regard under current law. Last year, there were 21 of these, and so that would have been revenue of $315. It's simply not economic to program for this functionality, and so we're asking that the law be made consistent with reality. In Section 2, we're talking about the foreign corporations. Foreign corporations mean not only corporations that are incorporated under the laws of exotic locations like Iowa and South Dakota, but also places like the United Kingdom, Canada, China, whatever. These foreign corporations register to do business in Minnesota. They have to register and also pay and file an annual renewal. Sometimes they forget to file their annual renewal. If they forget to file it in a calendar year, their authority to do business here is then revoked. They can later reinstate, and that's the subject of this bill, is the reinstatement. Under current law, the reinstatement requires a base fee of $250 plus the filing of the delinquent annual reports, and that could be 1, 2, 3, 4, however many years they've missed, at $115 a year. So you have variable tiers of an effective fee of $365, $480, $595, and $710, and so on and so on and so on. It's very complicated to program our computers. This is currently a manual process. We'd like to put it online, but it's very difficult to program the tiered fees. In an effort to make this revenue neutral with the current fee income, we've determined that the actual ideal fee would be rather an odd number. I think we calculated it out internally that it's like $504. $504 isn't a logical fee. $500 is a logical fee and is most likely to get compliance on the first shot without having to have letters back and forth for the extra $4. And so that results in a slight revenue loss to the general fund each year of about $2,800. But that's less than 1% off of being revenue neutral. It seems like the best compromise between ease of use for the customers and preserving the current revenues. If we're successful in getting to the flat fee, there is still a cost to program, but it's much less, and it's not a general fund cost. It's $5,000 to do the programming, with approximately $1,000 for maintenance each year. We try to forecast maintenance at about 20%, which is the standard in the computing industry. And that would come from the statutory fund that we have under 336.1-110, which is derived from certain fees. So those are statutory, that's statutorily set. So not a very large total impact in this biennium, $12,000. In the out biennia, $8,000.
Okay. Thank you for that testimony. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify to this bill? If not, members, do you have questions? Okay. Seeing none, I'm going to renew my did you have closing comments, Representative?
We appreciate your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1470 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Mack. Welcome. I'm going to move House File 795. And Representative Mack, do you want to describe your bill?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. Members, House File 795 is something that I've been working on for the past several years in different forms, with the ultimate goal of trying to give policymakers a tool by which we would be better equipped to make decisions based on what the return on taxpayer investment we're getting for any of our state government programs. Many of us know that we come here to the legislature with the best intentions of making sure that we're making strategic investments in public programs with our taxpayer dollar that are going to have good returns investing in our society and the kind of outcomes that we want to see. But the fact of the matter is we don't always have the best tools, a means by which we know whether or not we're getting a bang for the buck in how we're spending the billions of dollars that we spend. And so we are taking a model that has been produced actually by the Pew MacArthur Foundation. They have essentially put together something that allows states to come to the table. Right now there's 14 states that are a part of this program and sitting at the table doing this, where you can have your departments within your state give over information, give over data, and they essentially have created formularies that will give you information on what kind of return on taxpayer investment that you're getting. And so I have here with me Kelly Harder, who is the Social Services Director for Dakota County, and I will turn it over to him as he's been really more in the weeds on the details of this program. But Pew MacArthur would love to see Minnesota come to the table. Part of that is having legislation passed by the legislature, as well as the governor signing off on that. And so that is what this is a part of. It's moving forward in the Senate. We've been in contact with the governor's office, really excited about the potential that this offers to essentially give us a tool. And that tool would start off small in terms of what it would be telling us in terms of that return on taxpayer investment, but it's got the potential to be a build-out to many more state programs and essentially give policymakers an objective tool by which they can judge whether or not the programs that we are investing in are actually worth the money that we're putting into them. So I'm excited about the initiative. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd love to turn it over to Kelly Harder.
Welcome, Mr. Harder. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kelly Harder. I'm here on behalf of the MICA Association, and in my day job, I am also the Community Services Director for Dakota County. It's a pleasure to be with you here all today. What I'm going to do also is I'm going to ask when the aides can hand out really what an end product could look like for all of you. Regarding the cost-benefit analysis tool. So imagine, if you would, as a policymaker, where you actually have, and it's not just another ROI. I'm sure you've sat here and seen, oh, it's another ROI and another ROI. And there is validity all around. But what this offers is a framework that has over 13 years of rigor. It's actually the framework that the Washington Institute on Public Policy, WISIP, implemented over 13 years ago. And so it has had the rigor. It's been able to be used. It's used in multiple states to varying degrees and different levels of maturity. I think as a, you know, and at the end of the day, as Representative Mack had said, is imagine as a policymaker where you can have in front of you the output of an evaluation that has the legitimacy around an RI, so you then don't have to spend an inordinate amount of time having to discuss about the validity, what, you know, where did it come from, are they a valid organization or not, but it really is that cost-benefit tool, and its universality is the other piece. It's not a different one for corrections or a different one for human services, a different one for education, but that it is a similar tool and framework that you would all have in front of you, and I encourage you to look through the document that you do have in front of you. And for example, on page 5, you can see through juvenile justice. And what it goes into is specifically evaluating individual programs specific to populations and interventions and showing whether those investments and what they show, the return on those, are sound or if there's concern or where they're at. The level of rigor there's a significant level of rigor, I should say, that a program has to achieve to even be evaluated. Let me also say that many of our state departments and corrections, some in human services and I'm sure in education and others, they already have done modelings on return on investments, and they're sound and they're valid and they're important. This is not to replace the good work other state departments have done or are doing, but this is to augment and add value to that, but really offer up more of a universal framework so that the methodologies are consistent and continually valid. The other thing I'd like to offer up to all of you is that this provides an opportunity to work with Pew Institute. So the request in the bill for financing is actually to have a position within MMB that they would work with the Pew Institute. No money is exchanged to go to Pew Institute. They have the MacArthur funding that has allowed them to implement this. They provide they would come to Minnesota, provide technical assistance. They would provide what they've learned in other states. They would provide a inventory across all our program areas, and they would offer us up which programs are have the greatest potential for out of the gate to start building this type of platform. I would also refer to you on page 10 of this document as an example where we started with corrections, but it's another great example where you have children's mental health programs. We have substance abuse programs. So it cuts a pretty wide swath of capabilities. And obviously in Minnesota, we would look at many of these programs we do. They already have the methodologies built. I actually looked at just one of these programs, had about a 90-page mathematical methodology built in on the back end of it. We would be able, because we do a lot of these programs in Minnesota, put our specific data, our specific numbers that would operate through that. It's been a pleasure to work alongside folks at MMB along this journey this year as well. And I think, too, their willingness and opportunity to partner, not just with all of you as state policymakers, but I sit in front of seven other policy elected officials every 2 weeks, my county commissioners, who are also looking for this very type of tool and have this type of utility that allows us to make investments with local tax dollars as well. So this is a tool that we're offering up, has, I believe, utility vertically from a local level all the way up to the state and horizontally across multiple programs, that has that capacity to affect many programs and assist all of you in the continued great work you all do making priority choices on how to invest public dollars through the state of Minnesota. And with that, Madam Chair and committee members, I would stand for any questions.
Mr. Harder, can you tell me, we had a similar bill, I think it was just yesterday, Representative Barrett had presented a bill with Pew representative, I think it was Mr. Goodman, if I remember his name correctly, doing something similar. What's the differences between the two proposals? Are you familiar with that bill at all or had any contact?
Madam Chair and committee members, I am not aware of a companion bill like this that was being run, but if it is the Pew Results First, that would be a very similar, but I've not been made aware of any other bill similar to this, other than the one we're running in the Senate as well.
Okay. Is there anybody that wishes to testify to this bill from the public? Members, questions. Representative Earhart.
Good idea.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How do you figure a good return or a bad return? What you might consider a good return, I might consider a bad return. So we're not looking to make a profit. So when we say return, as you do in the normal economic sense, a profit is a better return than a loss. And all of these are a loss, really. So Representative Mack might say, well, that's a good return. And I might say, well, that's not really a. So we have the same discussion whether or not we're doing the study or not. Do we not?
That's
the question.
Mr. Harder.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart. Part of most every return on investment that is in the corrections and the human service and some of these social serving spaces where you're serving human beings, one of the critical components is that social cost. And that this is not to monetize the human condition and the human work in a way that takes away the impact that it has just to a dollar amount, saying that what we do, for example, in if you look at the juvenile justice, for example, and they look at this on page 5, and you look at the aggression replacement and training, for example, which is a very popular, very effective way of intervening, what it shows is that you would have a positive return on investment, because what they compare it against is a control group that if you don't do that intervention with juveniles, you do nothing. As compared to doing this type of intervention, we always look down the stream in corrections about recidivism, for example. So now they're back into the criminal justice system, and they actually cost out. What does it cost for local law enforcement to pick them up? The detention center, county attorney, state court system, and then there's county corrections, and they cost that out all the way along the value chain. And so what this offers us is an opportunity to say, what's the cost of not doing it? What's the cost benefit to doing it? You still ultimately get to make the decision on whether it's the right investment to make.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, though, we have two different philosophies over here that are going on in this institution, and one would say, cost-benefit-wise, we should be doing a bonding bill because of the savings on the money at this time because of the lower interest rates and so forth. And the other side would say, no, that's not a cost-benefit that we like to that we would like to have. And you can apply that, my philosophy here, on anything you're talking about. So what do we know except we have one more thing to argue about?
Representative Mack, do you want to comment to that? Or?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Earhart. I can appreciate the observation that we're always, we'll never be short of things to argue about, certainly. And I do, I appreciate your comparison to bonding, and I do understand that, at least in the world where I spend most of my time in health and human services, I do think that when you're looking at those, some of those social costs, and there's a few other people here who sit on Health and Human Services alongside with me, that some of those downstream costs, as Mr. Harder referred to, are things that we're trying to defer because it relates to the quality of the lives that Minnesotans are living, and how that relates to other people in the classroom and in on the roads, you know, all across the system. And so I do appreciate your comparison. I would separate a little bit because, as Mr. Harder said, we're not monetizing, as you said, we're not making a profit by doing wise return on investments here. The return is giving people a better shot downstream within their life, trying to, you know, course correct along the way. And I think that this would help us make better decisions. Would the arguing get any less? Probably not. But I do think we'd have an effective tool by which to make decisions with.
Just one more.
Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, if we take it away from the bricks and mortar and get down to at what level should we start bringing the young lives into the real world? You know, we could start at 4, we could start at 3, or we could put everybody from the birth on, according to somebody in the paper, on education that would benefit them all their life. But, you know, we'd have an argument about that because it's costly, and some of us don't want to spend money, and the others don't care if we spend every sou in the treasury. So it's not only bricks and mortar that I'm talking about. It's philosophically about any project that. So how do you resolve that? You must run into that,
Mr. Harder.
And Chair, Representative Earhart. One thing, my response to your valid observations and comments as well that I appreciate as Representative Mack would be that this the industry that I'm in charge of, which is social services, public health, corrections, veteran services, and extension. One area that's lacking in that industry is this level of sophistication to know or not whether the investments are, and to be able to monetize some of our work. We know they help people. It feels good. It is better. We have to start monetizing that so we can also translate that back to the taxpayer in a way that translates. People get a dollar out of their hand and what it comes back to them. They don't get some of the ways at which our industry speaks, where people roll their eyes back and tend to say, thanks for doing what you're doing because I don't understand it. We got to do a better job with that.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions. Maybe if either the author or the witness could comment about more extensively why the choice was corrections and human service programs, and then I have a follow-up.
Representative Mack or Mr. Harder?
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, Pew Institute, who has been implementing this, and based on the 13 years of Wisconsin and the states they've been into, know that most any return on investment they do in an area does lead to diverting away from the criminal justice system. And part of the formula on the community benefit is to keep youth, whether it's education that keeps them from behaviors of crime that lead them into that system, or adult crime or others. If you start in human services, one of the formula components is, do we keep them from going deeper into the criminal justice? So a cornerstone they like to just start with is, what's the return on investment to divert juveniles or adults from entering in the criminal justice or recidivating? And once they have that cornerstone, their pattern is they tend to use that formula multiple times as they then scale up more and more projects. So just fundamentally, they like to start in those areas because they affect the education modeling, they affect the children's mental health modeling, and they affect so many others.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, you touched on one of the reasons I raised the question. I've had two meetings recently with representatives of the business community, and they were concerned, and I'll reference higher education and what I'll call shopping. There's different terms that are used. But young people who graduate from high school, and there's uncertainty as to what they want to do. They feel that they want to get a post-secondary degree or certificate of some type, and they may enroll in a four-year institution, and they're there a semester or two, and then find that that was not really what they were interested in, not necessarily a good fit. They may drop out, stop out, or re-enroll maybe in a community college or tech college. And the state has invested maybe in a semester or two, by my example, in their education, and it's not really applied once they transfer to a different institution. So what we're working on there is the question of what that cost is, not only to the state, but to families when those choices are not made in a way in which they complete a degree or continue on in an institution. And it raises all kinds of cost-benefit questions. Yesterday, I spent a good deal of time on the phone with a researcher with the Midwestern Higher Education Compact, and I had called them and asked them if they were interested in doing research on that issue, and they are. They're going to be moving forward on it, and that would involve basically all the states in the in the Midwest, and also the Dakotas, depending on whether you count them Midwest or Western. I've had meetings with our House Research Department on that issue, trying to get a handle on what those costs are. And depending on the results, you know, the feeling then is, well, what do we do to help young people make better choices to begin with? And that reduces, as I pointed out, the cost potentially to families as well as the state. And that's why I raised the question of why you picked those particular two. If I were, because of my recent involvement, making the choice, I'd say, gee, let's put that question on relative to higher education. I've also had made contacts with the private colleges and with Minsky and the U of M on that very question, to have them get back to me with what they feel the cost of, and again, I'll use the term shopping due to the lack of any other term at this point. I don't know if they care to comment, but my main point was to comment about an interest in this general area, but maybe in a slightly different field.
Madam Chair, Representative Clausen, committee members, I would just refer to you as a point of reference to page 8 and 9 of the document I handed to you, that the potential build-out of this vehicle, this tool, look at all the educational, now it's not answering, I didn't see a way to say, oh, look on line 10 and here's your answer, Representative, but I would say that once again, we're bringing to you a tool and a vehicle as policy decision and investors and makers that might you build out a capacity. So that very question that you should ask and you are asking, and I appreciate that you ask it, would be able to be looked at within this framework. And you would have a tool instead of looking for another or looking for a different. Could it potentially be a value in that way as well as education?
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I did look at that point. I was looking, though, in addition to that, at the bill where you're beginning on line 10 of the bill.
Right.
In those two areas.
Right.
And my comments were relative to the bill and not necessarily to the bill and not necessarily the potential build out.
Okay. Did you wish to comment any further? Okay.
No, I think we
Representative Kahn
covered it.
I just wanted to make a comment about how terrific it is to be working with a national group with this prestige instead of just always looking internally. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one observation. It seems like it's a lot of work for one full-time staff. I think of community corrections, where I worked for a number of years. You know, there's three different models of probation services, the community corrections and the county and the DOC. And human services in the different counties offering the different programs. My fear is that you couldn't do, I mean, a concern I would have is that you couldn't do a good enough job to provide this kind of information with one staff trying to implement it. So how do you prioritize what it is you're going to take a look at? I mean, the idea seems reasonably solid, but how do you prioritize what exactly you're going to review? Because obviously you can't do everything, because with one staff it wouldn't be possible. And then secondly, have you got any pushback from counties regarding more work or unfunded mandate, essentially, as far as asking more work with no money? So those two things. Thank you.
Mr. Harder.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the question around implementation is one of which the beauty, again, that Pew brings when they come to the state is technical support and assistance. And one of the first things they do with a state when they get involved is to do that environmental scan and do an inventory and make a recommendation back to where a good starting point would be, where you could have some successes. And so clearly it is a journey we would be starting on. Part of this legislation and other meetings I've had, both at committee and outside, was, and at some point we just need to say we're going to start doing this instead of waiting for the perfect ideal situation to be, although I think this is about as good as there are. There are many institutions, many great education and others who do this work in other areas. This is the only one I know that is comprehensive across the program, so you don't have to change the model each time. So it is a starting point, and clearly it is that. And clearly the issue would be back in front of you about here's a recommendation, here's how much staff time it might take for implementation, and here's what that means. But Pew, based on their experience with multiple states thus far, has said a good starting point that has been successful is having a dedicated staff to work with our dedicated staff to get the base of the lay of the land, to then come back and report to all of you what this could look like for implementation in Minnesota, if you want to build it out or not, and what does that mean. And finally, to your question about the counties, this is coming to you on behalf of a county association. County association that has, heavily populated. We have not heard, I have not personally had any resistance from any county colleagues.
Okay. Representative Johnson, any follow-up? Members, any other questions? Oh, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with this, with caution. I wouldn't want it to become down the line sort of a fiscal note on steroids. But Art Rolenick in the past has shown research that shows that 17-to-1 return on doing early childhood learning in the first 3 years of life, the first 3 years, but we don't do it. But still, his doing that has pointed out and brought a certain amount of enthusiasm from the business community and the legislature, because it made an impact. Those numbers made an impact. So this could help if we just really don't get to the point where we start to monetize our work with human beings. So that's my caution.
Okay. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we do need to be fiscally responsible, so I'm going to support this bill. I have a couple concerns, though. One is that in the Pew document, they keep repeating working with staff, working with dedicated staff in our state agencies. So I'm just wondering if we're going to require our agencies to do this work, that their budgets may need to grow. So I would look at wanting to see a fiscal note on just the amount of staff time and work, and if that's going to increase the agency's budget. The other thing, I would like to see letters from the 14 other states that work with Pew, and some of their report books or their results that they've received and their experience working with Pew, just to see if this would be a good direction for Minnesota to go. And then the last thing, I'm a little worried, because I did have a conversation with the Commissioner of Corrections, Tom Roy, and I know they're doing some modeling now that's probably better than what Pew has established and created, and so maybe the language might be too strong, saying the Commissioner shall engage in this work with Pew, and maybe you might want to make some exceptions in the bill so there's more flexibility. Thank you.
Representative Mack, any comments for Mr. Harder to that?
I'll just briefly, and then let Mr. Harder comment on it. In regards to working with corrections, we have I've been in a couple meetings, and Mr. Harder's been in several with the Commissioner of Public Safety, and we have been very clear to say we acknowledge a lot of the great work that has been done in corrections and the model that has been to an extent across the country, and so we don't mean to, you know, to have this take the place of, and I think to a certain extent Commissioner Roy understands that. I think the key thing that members need to know is that while corrections, particularly in that area, does a lot of great work, the translatability in terms of the county's ability to use that information to educate the work that they do, and then, you know, even beyond corrections, just is not there. And so, yes, it's a great tool that the state has, but it's not translating to our counties well. And so what I think is really exciting about the proposal in front of you, not taking away from any of the work that's already being done, certainly adds on and has much greater potential to be a tool to a wider spectrum than just the people working at the Department of Corrections.
Okay. And members, just briefly, I apologize. There is a fiscal note that the Senate has done. For the biennium, it's a $312,000 cost that we're looking at. They have in their FTEs of two. That addresses Representative Johnson's concern, one that would be dedicated as a project manager and one as a data analyst that would be working with Pew Trust. We'll make sure that we email this out to you so you get a chance to review that as well. So, Mr. Harder, any other comments that you want to make to Representative Schultz's question?
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz and committee members, I would also offer you up that in participating with Pew, they've also, on a national level, put together a repository of ROIs. And think about the good housekeeping seal, and I'm not endorsing them or am I paid by them, but I'm just saying think of it conceptually of a good housekeeping seal where an ROI is validated, whether it's through this methodology or the ones they've done at corrections and others, and you put that on the shelf for this program. And then what you have an ability to do is to go pull that ROI off the shelf and look at it, and that you actually have for policymakers that ability to see that ROI. Because many states have done ROIs on programs that we have. We don't need to redo that again. But we also have now permission and a culture, and might we move forward in saying, let's actually pull it off the shelf. Let's actually look at it in committee, and then we'll decide whether we're going to have our differences or how we go about doing that. And that's really what we're laying in front of you, is an opportunity as a state to create a culture and create part of our new environment going forward where we're going to pull that off the shelf, whether Pew created it, but it has a good housekeeping seal of ROI of minimum standards you set forth. Maybe others have had that already, or other departments already did that good work as they do in Department of Corrections. And finally, I would say this also allows Minnesota and dedicated staff at MMB or wherever they might be to sit with other like professionals in other states and learn from them of the 16 or 17 other states who are doing this work. Why wouldn't we want to be sitting at that table to continue to lead out as this state has done for so many years? Thank you.
Great. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess listening to the discussion here and having dedicated staff, it looks to me like we're creating another silo in MMB. That, and the concern I have is that having this dedicated staff, and you said the Senate bill has two people, other work going on around them, that if they don't have enough to take up all their time, as opposed to not being able to get it all, everything done, as was a concern earlier, are we then they're not going to be able to help out at other parts of MMB? And again, that's just a concern. I mean, I remember back story about at one point in time in the past, there was a person that was dedicated to planning for natural disasters in the state of Minnesota, and there was a person dedicated to for nuclear, the effect of a nuclear holocaust. And while the natural disaster, we have enough tornadoes and floods and things through the year that they can do, and they're busy all the time. The other person, well, you make a plan and wait for it to happen, and that has nothing else to do. So just concerned about efficient use of our personnel, that if we're dedicating staff, are we going to create a silo here that this person or these two people cannot do anything else but work on this?
Representative Mack or Mr. Harder?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, I appreciate the concern, and I guess it is something to be cognizant of. I don't exactly know the nuances and ins and outs of how the commissioner or department heads within a department are able to manage their personnel. I guess it would be my hope that they have the ability to, some flexibility to maneuver based on where there's needs and best use their staff. I would imagine that the first couple years of rolling this out, you know, I'm happy to see that the Senate has two. I do think that's probably a more manageable number to manage this work. I don't see those two people getting bored for the first couple of years of trying to undertake this. And again, I think because of the build-out potential, you know, they can kind of manage the workload based on, okay, what program do we want to move to next, and at what point they can't manage that. You know, they move at a pace that they can absorb and what Pew recommends and has learned from other states. And so I do appreciate the concern and think it's something to be cognizant of, but I'm hoping that they're, you know, within the department, there's the ability to be somewhat nimble and flexible based on the needs and the load coming at them.
Okay. Representative Nelson, any follow-up?
Just Representative, Madam Chair, and it's just that in HHS, and I don't serve on those committees, but we hear complaints about that you have people that are dedicated to do certain jobs and they're not coordinating well and against each other, and we've even had that issue with departments not coordinating well with each other, and they overlap, and it's concerned about if we get create too many silos, we're going to have more people and not be able to be as nimble and efficient as we all want the state government to be.
All right. Representative Mack, any closing comments?
Madam Chair, thank you for the time. Appreciate the committee's support and would ask for their support. And we'll continue to take the concerns that were raised at this table as we have conversations with the Senate, but think it's an exciting opportunity for this state to be a part of a great national cohort and continue to lead and learn from other states. So, oh, and I just wanted to say, too, I think I'm looking up the bill that you referenced, Representative Barrett's bill that you guys heard, and my understanding is I just look at the brief summary that they are pretty separate issues as he's looking at, I believe, some employment incentive issues. So different from what we're talking about, we can continue to have that conversation offline. But just for any clarity that offers members. So with that, appreciate the support of the committee.
Great. Members, with that, I renew my motion that House File 795 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. Members, with that, we are adjourned.